inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us. And my resources all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise, oh, I can hear that sweet voice sing. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show, coming to you over the Radio Ear Network at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Standard Time in the United States, or 10 a.m. if you're on the West Coast of the United States, or 6 p.m. if you're in London. And is that Greenwich Mean Time? I think it is. And if you're missing this show, then how would you know? Or if you just want to hear it again, you can tune in at 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, or midnight on the West Coast of the United States, or 8 o'clock in the morning in London. And if you're tuning in for the first time, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what you can expect. On each of these shows, I will do some talking about change. Then Rollo May, the great innovative psychotherapist, wrote a book called Love and Will, in which he said, in times of change, and what other kinds of times are there? And certainly, we have been living in and continue to be living in a pretty big time of change. You can tell because if you're listening to this show when I'm actually broadcasting it, all of the political candidates who are in the middle of a campaign season are talking about change. But I'm not going to talk about the desirability of change or the inevitability of change. I'm going to talk about why it is so difficult for we human beings to make the changes in our lives that we want to, and sometimes think we need to. Most of the things that I say about change are concepts in my book, which is called When You Can, You Will. Subtitle, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. I added the subtitle because the publisher thought people wouldn't understand what When You Can, You Will means. And hopefully this time I've actually said it slowly enough. I got an email from a listener reminding me that although I have lived in the South, Florida is the South, for 13 years now, my New York rate of speech has not sufficiently slowed down. So, when you can, you will. It is true that it is so clear to me, this idea. The person who wrote to me said, you know this, the title really well, and you kind of run through it. And it is. It's clear to me that this idea that we can only do what we can do, and we can't do what we can't do. And so, when we can, we will, and not before. It's so clear to me that I forget that it is clearly not clear to everybody else. When I talk about this, I'm reminded that when my agent first tried to sell this book to a publishing company, many of the ones she approached told her that this was a dangerous book, one that was against the conventional wisdom. And what is this mysterious conventional wisdom? It is the idea that we can do whatever we want to do if only we want it enough and we try hard enough to get it. And although that is certainly the conventional wisdom, it doesn't make it true. My 30 years of private practice as a psychotherapist and more years of living and seeing my friends and family struggle to do what they wanted to do has convinced me that whatever the conventional wisdom says, we can't always do what we want to do, no matter how much we may want it or how hard we try. And more importantly, believing the conventional wisdom sets us up for despair. Because what can you think of yourself if you believe that you should be able to do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it, and that other people do that, and then it turns out that you can't? Well, most of us then decide that there must be something wrong with us. We may accuse ourselves of being self-destructive, but I don't believe that human beings are self-destructive. I believe we are self-protective and that we're always acting in our own best interests, even when we can't see how we're doing it. On each of these shows, I will be talking about why this is so and what we can do about it. And as I was saying, the concepts I describe here are all in the book, that is, When You Can, You Will. And there's also a handbook which describes the concepts a little bit more briefly, but also has all the exercises that are in the book. And there's also an audiobook for those people who, like me, prefer to take information in through their ears rather than their eyes. So in addition to talking about change, which apparently I have been doing now for a few minutes, I will be playing tracks off my CD. I made a CD called I Won't Go With a Whimper. They're songs that I wrote, and I'm singing them. And this first song you heard that opened the show and the one I play at the end of the show are both off the CD. But I'll also be playing other people's music, much of which you may not be hearing anywhere else because they are people who, like me, don't have record deals, aren't being played on the radio, and you can't get them in music stores. So I'll be playing them here. But I'll also be playing music that you might know, whatever I find that I like. And I'll be interviewing interesting people whenever I come across them. And as always, I will be thanking my engineer, IT guy, the go-to guy. His name is Josh Hackney. And telling you that if you ever need computer or recording or electronic help, and you're in Southwest Florida, or you want to send him transport, and as I pretty much always say, he is so worth it, you can reach Josh at 863-990-8349. Or you can email him at Josh C. Hackney. That's Josh C. Hackney, H-A-K-N-E-Y, at yahoo.com. And as I have been giving out Josh's information, I realize I haven't told you how to get in touch with me. So if you want to comment on the show, or you want to get the book or the CD or the workbook or anything, you can contact me at Lynn Burnfield. That's one word, and it has a lot of E's in it. That's LynnBurnfield at gmail.com. That's Lynn Burnfield at gmail.com. Last week, I began to talk about our families and our early childhood experiences and the impact that they have on our ability to be who we want to be and do what we want to do and make the changes we want to make as adults. I explained that families need balance. That balance, by the way, is called homeostasis. And in order to get this homeostasis or balance, families assign different qualities or tasks to different family members. It's efficient. It's efficient for the balance and the success of the family, but it's not always so efficient for the individual members. We all know the cliches about the oldest child or the baby girl. Well, they are for the most part true. Oldest children, and I can speak as one, are often bossy and autocratic and competent and workaholic. Having learned very early that they have to be responsible and to do things they don't want to do in order to please their parents. I've often seen overworked and unhappy people in my practice who had a sibling born too close behind them in a family where there weren't enough caretakers available. So they had little or no real childhood before mommy became pregnant and then was unable to lift them or care for them in the way they really needed. And then there was another infant who really required mommy's full attention. So these kids got it really early that their needs were not going to be met. And they learned how to deny those needs. That's the most efficient thing to do in that circumstance, is you deny the needs. And they denied them not only to the grown-ups, but to themselves, and filled up their lives instead with the work which brought them approval as small children. You can see how this learning would influence everything that a person does and doesn't do. Last week, if you heard the show, I told the story of Frank, who even under doctor's orders could not make himself slow down at work. And I had a wonderful uncle, Uncle Charlie. Uncle Charlie was this big, blustery guy who never went anywhere without the cigar chomped in his mouth. He was a very, very successful man, and he loved taking care. He always picked up the tab. He always gave great presents. When my cousin, his daughter, and I were kids, we were counselors at a day camp, and I found out much later that Uncle Charlie paid our salaries. I think Uncle Charlie was the most successful man in our extended family system, and he loved that role, and he was really good at it. But he got ill in his early 50s, not the illness that was terminal, but an illness that made it impossible for him to work. And he died shortly thereafter, not of the illness that stopped him from working. And I believed then and believe now that he couldn't go on living if he couldn't go on living the way he always had. So it is with many oldest children that it is their identity, or what I like to call, and call in the book and the handbook and the workbook, and the audiobook, I call it our cover story. I'm going to talk more about our cover story, maybe even later in this broadcast, but certainly in future broadcasts, because it is our cover story which becomes our identity, and then it becomes so important that, like my uncle, we may not be able to want to go on living without it. And Another classic example is the baby girl, who's adored from day one for doing absolutely nothing other than being cute, which of course she didn't have to work at and can take no credit for, and learned that that was what her family wanted from her, that she was cute and she liked being taken care of. Some of these little girls are encouraged to become demanding. Others are encouraged to become compliant. But almost none are encouraged to express their competence. This was what had happened to Susie. Susie came to see me to deal with the problem of being late. She couldn't seem to get anywhere on time, and she made herself crazy over it. She came in, she described herself as a ditz. This was the label her family had chosen for her, and the way her husband also thought of her. In fact, Susie was highly intelligent and capable, but she felt compelled to keep this image of herself as someone who was incompetent. This image was what was being served by her lateness. It continued to present her as some kind of scatterbrain, and it continued to make it possible for her parents and her husband to indulge her and to see themselves as taking care of their dear dits. So what could this mean? Well, it means that what you are naturally, what you were born with, what you came in with, may get covered over with a veneer of whatever it was your family needed you to be to maintain its balance. And that veneer stays with you, so that no matter how you're acting today when you're grown up, it may not be all of who you really are. And it may actually even feel a little wrong and not quite fit, but you don't know why. Another example is you may have been a very smart little boy or girl, but your parents felt inadequate and only felt good about themselves when they were smarter than you. Of course, when you're little, that's not hard to do. But after a while, you know, your native intelligence begins to show. Well, they could get you either not to show it, or better yet, to think that your intelligence was unattractive or even dangerous or ugly. Then you would stop expressing it. Families do this without really meaning to, by greeting expressions of intelligence with remarks like, "Nobody likes a smart ass," or "Who do you think you are?" or teasing you and calling you a show-off or a smart aleck, so that you may have become ashamed of your intelligence and learned how to hide it. Or, like Susie, you might have found ways of acting like a ditz. But you can see how this will get in your way. If, for example, you're applying for a job or you want to go to college or you just want to have your own opinions. To help you see just how your particular family was balanced and to help you figure out what role you had been assigned to play there, I described in last week's session the family pie exercise. And I'm going to quickly recap it here for those of you who missed that show. But before I do that, I'm going to play a song from an album by Jane Hoffman. If you were listening last week and the week before, then you would have heard a track, or a minute of a track, from her her lovely CD called A Journey. I used it when I did the guided imagery exercise, and also when I gave you an opportunity to do the family pie exercise. The track I used was Solo Flute, but I'm going to play several tracks from that album that mostly they're flute and piano. Play one now, and then I'll talk about the family pie, and then I'll play another one a little bit later, and probably another one after that. You can see Jane live playing her flute with a violist and a guitar player if you happen to be in the neighborhood of Venice, Florida, on Sunday the 17th of February. She will be playing at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Venice. That's at 1971 Pine Brook Road. And you can get more information about that if you want, by going to Jane's website. That's www.janehoffman.org. Or you can always get information about this stuff from me. And you can always email me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. So now, a beautiful track from Jane's album. Thank you. That was the beautiful playing of Jane Hoffman on flute and Mike Markovarich on piano. And I'm going to play at least one, maybe two more cuts from that CD today. But now, for those of you who missed the family pie, I'm going to describe it to you. If you were listening last week and you did your family pie, you can listen along here and maybe you'll learn something new. I'm going to add information. But if you didn't, you weren't, you hadn't, then what you do is you draw a large circle on some piece of paper, and you divide that circle into as many pieces as there were people in your family. And you label each one of the pieces with the name of a family member. Mom, Dad, yourself, your sister, your brother, your grandma if she lived with you. This is your family pie. And then you write in each one of the pie pieces the qualities that describe the person that you named there. So it might be hardworking, funny, clever, international, really, Lynn, interesting, you know, just whatever it is, that lazy, selfish, unselfish, whatever it is, you put in all the qualities as they describe the people in your family, including yourself. Now, when you've filled in as much as you can, and this may be not that simple, you know these people all your life, but still, somebody can be difficult to describe, and that somebody might even be you. But when you've put in as much as you can, step back and see what's there. Are there patterns? There almost always are. Sometimes the men are one way and the women are another. Sometimes the parents share some qualities and the children share others. Some of the families may be over-responsible while one or more of them are irresponsible. You get the idea. Often, we see that there are qualities in other family members that we would like to have, or qualities in other family members we're glad we don't have. Well, believe it or not, I believe that all the qualities that exist in any family system, that is, all the qualities that you've listed in any of the pie pieces, exist in all of the family members. So let's say you've written hardworking in your pie piece and lazy in the pie piece of your brother. Well, whether you like it or not, you have the capacity to be lazy, and he has the capacity to be hardworking. But you don't demonstrate these abilities because they weren't assigned to you. Chances are, if you found these two opposites in your family pie, or other opposites, you may feel judgmental about your lazy brother. The family may get a lot of mileage out of talking about or worrying about his laziness and trying vainly to get him to work harder. Those family members who are hardworking may feel superior to him. Now, none of this matters all that much unless what you want to do, the change that you want to make, requires you to act in a way that you would think of as lazy. Then you run right into the judgment you have about laziness in general, and your brother's laziness in particular. You wouldn't want to be like him. You know what the rest of the family thinks about his laziness, and you don't want them thinking that about you. You don't want to think about yourself the way you think about him. But what if, like Frank in last week's show, your doctor told you that your health depended on slowing down, and slowing down felt like laziness? You can see how this might give you a real quandary. This might be a real dilemma. The thing you want to do and need to do would force you to do something you don't want to do that would embarrass you. The good news is that because the capacity to be lazy is already in your family system, you already have that ability. You already know how to do it. You've watched it closely over the years in your brother, and you have the world's best role model for it anyway. But before you can capture and use the quality that you need, you have to get over your belief, the one that the whole family holds on to, including your brother, that laziness is ugly, to be shunned. But even if you could do that, even if you could find a way to understand that laziness, the capacity to be lazy, is as important as the capacity to be hardworking, and that it's important for you to be able to do both for your mental and physical health, even if you could do that and begin to find that capacity inside of you, there's another thing that will stop you. Remember at the top of the show, I talked about balance, homeostasis, and how important it is to a family to maintain its balance. Well, that balance depends on everyone continuing to act out his or her role. So if you changed your role, if you began to act lazy, the balance of the family would be in danger. Someone else would have to work harder to compensate for you, and no one will want to. So even if the family sees that you're overworking and it's hurting you, and even if they encourage you to slow down, if you really do, be prepared for backlash. One of the most annoyed people may very well be your brother. It may seem odd, but one of the reasons that families can maintain their balance is that each member gets attached to his or her assigned role. Even those qualities or roles which are thought of as undesirable. So your brother is attached to his label as the lazy one, even if he seems to want to be different. And he certainly doesn't want to take over your role as the hardworking one. So you'll get resistance from him. In case you're wondering, this would go the opposite way as well. If your lazy brother suddenly became able to express his ability to be hardworking, even though you and the family had for years been trying to get this to happen, all of you would begin to do things to undermine it and to try and bring him back into line, to maintain the family balance. Because the hardworking ones who think of laziness as ugly would not want to take on this role, and somebody has to maintain the family balance. In some cases, if the family can't do anything to stop you, they may just ignore your change. So Judy came to see me about losing weight, and what we realized as we had worked together was that Judy's issue with weight had to do with a quality that she had been assigned by her family, and that was the quality of indulgence. The rest of her family was very, very rigid. They were stick thin, and they didn't indulge in any way. You know, they didn't have fancy cars, and they didn't have fancy furniture, and they didn't indulge. They were rigid. But indulgence as a quality existed in that system, and it was pretty much all assigned to Judy. And Judy expressed her indulgence mostly by overeating. She was more overweight than was good for her, and she was worried about her health. And so we worked on this aspect of indulgence versus stinginess. She did her family pie, and it was quite clear that most of everybody else in the family had this rigid, stingy ability to deny themselves. And Judy had gotten the opposite. So we worked on her ability to capture the quality in the family which allowed for self-control, for the opposite of indulgence. And Judy lost weight. Now, when I was seeing Judy, she was living in California, but all of her family was living in Minnesota. She lost about, 35, 40 pounds before she went back home for a wedding. She was very excited. Everybody was going to be happy. Everybody was going to notice. Everybody was going to be so proud of her. She was going to be so happy. She came back from the wedding, and she reported that nobody noticed. People went right on talking about her as though she still had a terrible weight problem. They watched what she ate. They teased her if she had a piece of cake. They went on behaving as though she was still the person holding on to the quality of indulgence, because that's what the family needed. In a few minutes, I'm going to play another track from Jane Hoffman's beautiful CD. Maybe I'll even play two. They're really They're really wonderful. And if you get a chance to see Jane this weekend, you really should jump on it. And then I'm going to do a recap of what I've been talking about today, about the family pie and the qualities that we share and family balance and homeostasis. But I want to talk about something that's very, very different for a while. This weekend I went to the movies and I saw a movie called The Golden Compass. I'd read the book. Actually, there it's a trilogy and I've read all three. It's fantasy fiction. I don't know if you know what fantasy fiction is. I am a big fantasy fiction fan. I think actually there must be many, many of us, although mostly people don't talk about it, because fantasy fiction is very popular when it comes out in movies. So Star Wars was fantasy fiction. Lord of the Rings is fantasy fiction. Harry Potter is fantasy fiction. I think, although don't hold me to this, that the very first fantasy fiction story is King Arthur and the Round Table. The stories in any fantasy fiction book or movie are always identical. It is the exact same story over and over again. There is going to be a fight between right and wrong, or good and evil, or the light and the dark, or the force and whoever the force was fighting. There's going to be a battle for the inhabitants of the earth. And bad, evil, black, dark is very, very, very powerful and threatening to sweep away the light and make slaves of whoever the inhabitants are. And there's a hero. It's almost always a young boy. Not almost always, it's pretty much always a young boy. And he has been, for one reason or another, hidden. So that even he doesn't know that he's the hero. And over the course of the story, he is discovered. And he's told, essentially, that he's the hero. And usually in the early stages of the story, he fights it. He's a reluctant hero. It can't be him, and he doesn't want to, and he doesn't have the skills anyway. But then over time, he comes to see that he does have the skills, and inevitably it's going to be his job to fight for right. Oh, I guess Superman must also have been sort of fantasy fiction. You can see why I say that lots of people must really like fantasy fiction, because all these things are so screamingly popular. Although if I say to someone, do you read fantasy fiction, if they know what it is, they say no, but mostly they don't know what it is. Anyway, The Golden Compass is... Oh, and I didn't actually finish. Of course, there's usually a mentor, you know, the Gandalf and Obi-Wan and the professor in Harry Potter. There's a guide or a mentor who helps the reluctant hero to hone his skills, Yoda. And finally, the boy accepts his responsibility and fights the good fight, and we're all saved until the next threatening darkness. A while back, I thought I would write a book about what it meant to be female in America. I was going to call it, If You Hitch Your Wagon to a Star, You're Still a Wagon. And one of the things I wanted to talk about in that book was women in fiction. In the in fantasy fiction, those saviors are all young boys, or young men by the time they have to take on the dark. But they're all boys. In The Golden Compass, which ironically was written by a man, the heroine is a girl, Lyra. And she isn't the slightest bit reluctant. She's frightened, but she She's taking it on. She's doing it. She's excited by it, actually. And this makes that story really, really special. Not only for we women, you know, who are looking for role models that don't look exactly like men. In my book, I was going to talk about mystery fiction. Oh, my God. Until quite recently, the only female detectives were either spinsters like Agatha Christie's Miss Marple, or they were men, really, and not even in skirts. They just acted like men. So it's really significant, it seems to me, that we have women, girls, showing up in these stories about the people who save. And, you know, it's funny, I didn't think about this before I started to talk about this, but of course here we are for the first time in our history with the possibility of having a woman leading the country. And maybe it's not such an accident that we also have the Golden Compass playing at theaters near you. And so if this has any meaning for you, maybe you don't like magic, maybe you don't like stories where things are mystical, but maybe you just want to go and see a story where it's a young girl who saves everybody's ass. Okay, so now I'm going to play Jane, and then I'm going to talk more about how we can each save our own ass. I'll be back in a little while. Thank you. Today, I've been talking about how complicated we are. I always like to quote Walt Whitman when I talk about this. Walt Whitman, who seemed to know instinctively the truth of this, he said in his epic poem, Song of Myself, I love that, Song of Myself, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." We are all large. We all contain multitudes. So Judy contained the ability to indulge and the ability to be stingy. And in my other example, the person who could work hard could also be like his lazy brother. And the brother could be like his hard-working sibling. We can not only contain multitudes, we can contain opposites. And in fact, we pretty much all do, even though we don't like to think of ourselves as opposites. I got a call from a client once in which she said, oh my God, can I be angry and happy at the same time? We're so limited. It's only our belief that we're one way and that that way is somehow important to hold on to. And that's one of the things that stops us from changing. Of course, that belief and or our family's need for balance is a big obstacle to making the changes that we want to make. But if you know that you can be so much more than you are, you can be the opposite of what you are, that will take you on the journey. It will start the journey towards the change and actually to becoming all of who you really are. So while I've been talking here, have you been wondering about the changes you might want to make in your life? Are they the ones everyone wants? Do you want to work out more and lose weight? Or maybe you want to be more assertive. You want to have an opinion. Maybe you've always been someone who couldn't exactly make up their mind what they thought, and you want to know what you think. Or maybe you want to be less responsible, or more responsible, or funnier, or... In my family, my sister and I are chatterboxes. This will not come as a surprise to you. And my brother is kind of silent. Are you the one who always sends holiday and birthday cards, or are you the one who can't seem to remember any of that? Maybe you could begin to think about how you became what you think of yourself as. It didn't just happen. You weren't born remembering everybody's birthday. You were encouraged to be that way. And are there things about the way you've been acting or the person that you've been that you'd like to stop or change? Well, don't try and stop that now. This is a process. We live in a society that is so goal-oriented, you know, it's just do it, whatever it is, that we overlook the fact that human beings require process to change. The change may seem instantaneous, like the mythical overnight sensation, but like that mythical beast, usually there's a lot of process preceding that achievement. I'm going to talk more in future shows about the way that you can begin this process, what the process looks like. But let me encourage you now simply to begin. Simply to wonder, to think about how you define yourself. Look at your family pie. What did you say about yourself? Begin to think about how you got that way. And think about your family members. What did you say about them? And are they different? And how did they get that way? And do you want any of the qualities that you see in the other pie pieces of your family pie? I think I'm going to close the show playing a song of mine, and then there'll be another song of mine. But this one is called Behind the Woman, There's a Child. And it seems to me that that's an appropriate song for this show where I've been talking about contradictions that we hold within us. I will tell you that this song, Behind the Woman, and also the one that's going to end the show, and the one that started the show, are all from my CD, CD is called I Won't Go With a Whimper, and damn, I'm trying not to. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more or even buy the CD, you can find it on the web at cdbaby.com/cd/Lynn Burnfield, and that will take you right to my CD. I'll say it one more time, a little more quickly. cdbaby.com/cd/Lynn Burnfield, and that will take you right to my CD, I Won't Go With a Whimper. And so now I'm going to play Behind the Woman, and I think that's going to take us right up to the closing song. So let me say, this has been Lynn Burnfield coming to you on Tuesday, that I will be here again next week. I will be talking more about why you can't do what you can't do and what you can do about that. And I hope that you'll be here too.
I can work whole damn day, way into the night. Look like I don't need to play. I make out all right, and although I can fool you with my grown-up woman style. Behind the woman, there's a child. Behind the woman, there's a child. The surface is calm, the current is figure. I've both seen better days. Well, of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang.